For those of you who have been with us for a while, we are going through the different creation texts in the Bible, the lengthy ones. And right now we're in Psalm 147. Let me turn there quickly. Here we go. I got too many markers in my Bible here. And we started off with Psalm 147. We looked at the text that dealt with the stars and spent some time studying what the Bible has actually got to say about stars and how they fit into making possible the existence of human beings in the universe, which means next time you celebrate Thanksgiving, thank God for the stars, because you wouldn't be here without the stars.
Thank your lucky stars.
Thank your lucky stars, right? They're all lucky. You need all 50 billion trillion of them. Or as one of my former professors, Carl Sagan, would say, remember, you're all star ashes. So all of our bodies are made from the ashes of stars. But you need just exactly the right number, right kind, right time in order for human life to exist. Then Psalm 147 segues to the clouds and the rain, which you see in verse 8, speaking of God, He covers the sky with clouds. He supplies the earth with rain. Keep in mind, most planets that are smaller than the earth don't have clouds at all. He covers the sky with clouds. He supplies the earth with rain and makes grass to grow on the hills. And he says, why? He provides food for the cattle and for the young ravens when they call. So it's making the point that God has set up this water cycle so that rain falls from the clouds so that the animals living on the continental land masses can actually have food to eat. And there's one thing we're going to look at, and I had you last week, or 2 weeks ago, because we didn't meet last week, but 2 weeks ago we were studying this text, actually go into a parallel passage, which is Job 36 and 37 and 38, basically about 2.5 chapters that deal in detail with these two verses you see in Psalm 147. Making the point that God has not only set up a water cycle, but a very complex water cycle, so that it's possible for the continents to support an abundance and great diversity of animal life, which Psalm 139 makes a point is crucial for enabling human beings to launch and sustain civilization. Without the animals, we can't do it. We need the animals. Job 39 makes a point that God gave us a cow, He gave us a horse, He gave us a donkey, gives us a long list of animals that He gave us, and then explains how each one was crucial for launching, sustaining civilization. We did something unusual a couple of weeks ago. We broke you up into small groups, and I gave each group the challenge of going through the Job text to see the different kinds of precipitation that God has established when He set up the water cycle, which you see in creation day 2 in Genesis 1, let there be water above and water below. But what kind of water above and what kind of water below? And I gave you the challenge in your small groups to go through those three chapters in Job and just kind of collect a list. And some of you went a little bit further than I expected, which was good. And kind of what I've done is taken what you've discovered and broken it down into three categories. So category number one would be frozen precipitation. And we're actually going to be segueing to the slide when we talk about frozen precipitation. But it mentions five kinds. Snow, hail, and frost. Something you see repeatedly referred to in different creation texts in the Bible. But there are two more. It talks about ice, and it talks about the frozen surface of the deep. So it's referring to the fact that the water cycle has been set up in such a way that you actually get sheets of ice over the seas. And you get ice that accumulates on the mountains and ice that accumulates on top of lakes in the wintertime. Now, the point that we're going to be developing here is you see these five kinds of frozen precipitation? You need all five if you want to sustain advanced human civilization. So we're going to be looking at why we need all five. And then we get a rather long list of the liquid precipitation forms. And the three you see repeated frequently is rain, dew, and mist. Now when it says mist, you can also put a slash through there, fog. Mist, fog, they're kind of the same. We've got one Hebrew word that kind of encompasses that. So, think of mist in the atmosphere, but also fog qualifies. I grew up in a place where the fog was actually wet. I mean, you would come in having walked to school in the fog, and there, you would just be, have water all over you from the density of the fog. But then what we see in the book of Job, it mentions showers, and it mentions a downpour and torrents of rain. Now, that kind of makes the point that when rain falls from the sky, it can fall in three categories, showers. So when the weatherman's on TV and says there's going to be showers tomorrow, that does not mean torrential rain. That means there's going to be sprinkling of rain that might last for, say, an hour, go away for an hour, come back for an hour. Showers basically means intermittent drops of rain falling from the sky. It's going to water the land, but it's not going to soak you. Contrasted with a downpour, which means you're going to get a lot of water falling hard from the sky for a period of time. Then there's this phrase, torrents of rain. And torrents of rain means you're going to have downpour that's long-lasting. And this is what brings about floods. And actually, that's another reference. It also just actually talks about floods of water in the text. So one of the things we're going to be looking at is, why do we need floods? You know, floods are considered disasters, but why do we need them? And some of the translations bring up the term hurricane. You won't see that in all translations, but some of you noted in your translation there's the word hurricane. So we'll be looking at the hurricanes. And then several of you went beyond just looking at the different forms of liquid and frozen precipitation I asked you to seek for, and actually looked at some complementary aspects of the water cycle. Swirling clouds, lightning bolts, thunder, and wind. And you know, all those are critical in order to bring about these different forms of frozen and liquid precipitation. So on your advice, I've decided to include that in our study. Why we need lightning bolts, why we need thunder, wind, and swirling clouds. Interesting references in the book of Job, how God will send wind to cool the animals so they can keep working for us. Just one little reference you can look for there. We're going to actually be going through each of these different items, seeing what the text has got to say about them, but also what the book of nature is telling us about why each of these is crucial. Now, the whole point here is, if you want advanced life on planet Earth, you not only need a water cycle, you need a very complex and stable water cycle. And that's the message you kind of see starting in Genesis 1. God not only gave us a water cycle, He gave us a stable water cycle. Why? Because we can see that you could have easily a water cycle that would last for 100,000 years and shut down for the next 4 billion. That's one scenario. But we see here on planet Earth, it's had a persistent, long-lasting, stable water cycle, and we happen to be living in the era where the water cycle is the most complex it's ever been, which is why we're able to sit in these chairs and actually drive cars to come to a study like this. Yes?
Is that the way it actually says in the Bible, that it was a water cycle?
It doesn't use that technical term. What you see in Genesis 1, creation day 2, let there be water in the expanse above and water in the seas below. Now, the expanse refers to the troposphere where clouds form, but basically you get a single sentence in Genesis chapter 1. But you get 2.5 chapters that expand creation day 2 in the book of Job. So it's the book of Job that gives us the most detailed description of the water cycle, describing the different forms, how God has designed it so the water doesn't just fall back on the oceans. Excuse me. It actually gets transported from the oceans to the continental land masses. That's why you're going to need the winds. Because you could easily imagine a water cycle where the water evaporates from the oceans, falls back on the oceans. Yeah. That'd be fine for the fish, but it's not going to help those of us living on the continental land masses.
Yeah.
You know, without exquisite design, the continents would all be deserts.
They've kind of known about the atmosphere and all that stuff. I think what I've read is that most of the societies then, up to the Tigris and the Euphrates, was that they thought that the sky was held up with pillars and firmaments and the firmaments there was another ocean of water
Yeah, that's the Babylonian view. The Babylonians actually thought that above the sky was a brass dome. And there was holes in the brass dome, and there was an ocean above the brass dome, and every once in a while God would open up the spigots so that the holes would normally be blocked, but when God wanted to, he would kind of pull a little lever, and all the holes would be exposed, and water would fall down, and enough water falling down, he would close it up again.
But I don't see how the Jews would be any smarter than the Babylonians.
Well, the reason why they're smarter, Moses was inspired by the guy who actually set up the water cycle. And I think you weren't here a couple of weeks ago, but this is something that some of the people in the groups actually brought out. They made the point that what you see in the book of Job are insights in the water cycle that would not at all have been common knowledge to people living in Mesopotamia or the Persian Gulf area. Because it's actually talking about glaciated plains, and they were obviously not living in an area where they'd ever be able to see that. And yet it's in here. So, and talks about, if you're in the Mesopotamian plain, you don't get torrents of rain. I mean, you did during the Genesis flood, but that's a place where they just don't get, they get mist, but they do not get torrential rainstorms. Yet it talks about that here. So this is one of the evidences that what we're reading here really is the inspired Word of God, because it contains information that's beyond the scientific knowledge of the people that were, quote, inspired to write it. And that's kind of the message that we see in the Bible, is that the book is written by men, but it's men who've been inspired by God's Holy Spirit, and they actually are writing things that they don't understand themselves. That's the message you see in 1 Peter 1, that these prophets of old that were inspired by God to write the Old Testament were often recording material that they themselves did not understand, and recognized they were being inspired by the Holy Spirit for the teaching and understanding of future generations. So this is why every successive generation of humanity has learned more from the biblical texts than previous generations, because it was actually inspired by God's Holy Spirit to communicate to people living in all generations. Yes?
Your idea that they would write down things they wouldn't even know, well, consider that much of the book of Daniel, an angel explains to Daniel the whole future of the world. He says, you're not going to understand any of this. You're going to go to sleep and you're going to be resurrected at the end of time. And all this stuff's going to come about, but you won't understand it until the time of the end.
That's true, because in the book of Daniel, Daniel's talking to the angel, and he says, I don't understand. Please tell me. And the angel says, it's not for you to understand. You're being used by God's Holy Spirit to record this for a future generation. It's not for you. And basically, he told Daniel to shut up. Stop asking questions. This is not for you. It's for people living in the future.
And the secretary.
Well, he was, and because here he was writing about the Greeks, and the Greeks were really not a factor on the scene yet, and he was being told that the Greeks at one time would rule a known world, and that they would eventually be replaced by a powerful nation to the west of Greece, a reference to the Roman Empire. And you can imagine, here's Daniel writing in the 6th century BC, who are these Greeks, who's this nation of the west? Why are they going to be interested in Jerusalem? Because what you see there is a prophecy that this powerful nation to the west of Greece would come in at the time when the Greek Empire was split into four and stop the king of the south from doing what he intended to do in Jerusalem. And that actually happened. The Roman Emperor spoke to the Greek king and said, you don't go. If you go, we're going to stop you. And so they stopped. And not all that was for the benefit of the Jewish people. So, anyway, what I wanted to do before we kind of go down this list is talk to you about some new research that's been released, which really demonstrates how God has set up the water cycle in a wonderful way to give us a blessed situation. And this is the latest Greenland ice core drill. There are three sites basically in central and northern Greenland, where they've done deep ice cores. Three of them that have gone deeper than 100,000 layers of annual ice. The deepest one has been the one called North Grip, which shows 123,000 annual years of ice deposition. Now, what this does is kind of take you back through the last ice age, back to the last warm interglacial, but what researchers wanted to do was to get a record in Greenland, because we have one in Antarctica, but they really wanted to see what was going on in the north. And moreover, what they're seeing in Greenland is they're getting much more detailed information in the recent ice layers than they're able to get in Antarctica. What they wanted was an ice core in Greenland that would be deep enough not only to get back to the last warm interglacial, but actually to explore a few tens of thousands of years before the warm interglacial, so they actually have a complete, a little more than a complete cycle, going from the present back to the past. We're in a warm interglacial now, to get back to the last warm interglacial, but actually to see what happened that precipitated the last warm interglacial. Now, the reason why they went to this North Grip site, researchers presume that's the place where they would have the deepest ice. Indeed, that is a place where they have the deepest ice. But after a decade of research, they discovered another site that they presume would have many more layers of ice. But also, they had to wait for sophisticated technology because this NEEM site, and by the way, you want to know where the name comes from, they refer to the last warm interglacial as the Eemian era. And so this is the place where they were going to dig or drill an ice core and explore the full extent of the events before, during, and after the Eemian era. So that's where it got its name. But researchers discovered, although the ice isn't as thick there, still 2.5 kilometers thick, so that's a lot of ice, but they notice that this is a site where the bottom layers were overturned, which means you'd have layers like this, and then tectonic forces would work to kind of flip them over. And so they said, we're going to need a core drilling team that's able to piece together the places where it's flipped over and actually reconstruct a continuous historical record of ice layers. So they needed to wait until they had the appropriate technology. Then finally they went to the site. An international team that involves like 30 different nations went to the site and began the drill. And what has happened is they've now got a scientific report that releases the detail of the drill. So that's what I'm going to talk about. But just to give you a heads up, it reveals that this particular warm interglacial is unlike any other. There is no warm interglacial like the one we're in right now. And because we're in such an extraordinary warm interglacial, it's actually possible to launch and sustain human civilization. So I'm kind of giving away the story here. But the story here is if God put us in a different interglacial, we wouldn't be able to launch and sustain global high-technology civilization. It took what they called the long summer to make it happen. Anyway, I got a couple of slides here kind of showing what was going on at this site. This is the Neem site. And you say, what's that big black thing there? Maybe we can turn off one of the lights so you can see a little better.
Bomb.
That's not a bomb. That's the warm room. All those other buildings and tents you see out there, they're not heated. And by the way, the people go to sleep in the cold places. You're not allowed to sleep in the warm room. The warm room is where they have all their technology located, although they've got some of it in the cold facility too. But hey, if you need to warm up, you go into that big black thing there. But if you want to sleep for the night, you got to go into one of those red tents. And so you do sleep at the ambient temperature, though it's enough to keep the wind out. Here's a close-up of the bomb where you can go, and you can see the door here. This is the door, so it's actually quite big, and there's several stories here where they have all the equipment for the research team. And this is where you actually live. You live in one of those tents. And somebody thought it'd be really cool to bring up a picnic table. So there's a picnic table there. Not that anybody uses it, but there is a picnic table there for those who like to have their lunch at 80 below zero. You can sit down and have that. And this is kind of what... Yeah, have a cool beer, right? So, but that's a nice day at the Neem site, and this is a not so nice day when the wind is blowing, and you have to be very careful. Otherwise, you're not going to make it back to your tent or one of the warm building. But here they are actually at the drill site, so this is where they're working on. Drilling down a core, and then in the cold laboratory, they, you know, if I go back here, yeah, it's these buildings over here where they actually put the ice core. So it's actually a big long tent area here where they analyze the ice cores, and here is okay, what happened here? Here we go. There's a close-up of the ice core, so it gives you an idea of what that ice core looks like. And here's the tent where they actually do the analysis of the ice cores. And the people that work there have to work at the ambient temperature, so it might be 60 below. That's why they have those parkas there. But hey, this guy's got his parkas off because actually he's inside, cuts the wind a little bit. But that's what it's like to work there. And so, do you actually get people to sign up for these research projects? Yeah, they really do. I worked with some of these people, and in fact, there was one gal who actually came to this class once, and she spent 2 years at the South Pole doing research in the cosmic background radiation. And she was telling me that before she was allowed to go, she had to get some medical training in case she needed to do surgery on herself if something went wrong there, because they're not going to be able to fly doctors in. When conditions get bad there. So if something goes wrong where you need to do an appendectomy on yourself or whatever. So, or, in fact, she told me a story about somebody who was down there and got cancer, and she had to perform surgery on herself to deal with the cancer she had. But, you know, she actually was in phone contact with a surgeon that told her what to do and when to do it.
Wow.
So that's what life is like when you go to these places, yes.
Brings new meaning to the phrase, suit yourself.
Suit yourself, all right.
Even that,
I'm guessing that's not the first time you told that joke.
even in that cold ambient temperature, do those cores evaporate?
They don't. No, it's kept cold enough that they don't have to worry. And by the way, even in summertime, it never gets warm enough to cause a melt problem. I mean, that's one reason why they know these are annual layers. It never gets cold enough to melt. So you don't have a problem with melt and remelting. South Greenland, you do. But this is far enough north in Greenland that you never have to worry any time of the day or year of anything melting. It just simply never gets that warm.
What about sublimation?
Well, again, it's cold enough that they don't have to worry about that. But notice that this was a pretty thick core they got there. So if it sublimated a little bit, wouldn't be an issue. But as I understand it, once they get it into this facility, it's stable. And it'll remain stable for decades.
How long is it? About 50 feet?
Well, this particular building is about 100 feet long. But yeah, they do cut the cores. I don't know how long the cores are, but from what you can tell here, it looks like they're at least 60 feet long, and maybe longer.
So. About 2 inches in
diameter? No, it's thicker than that. It's about 4 to 6 inches in diameter. So yeah, I figure 4 inches at least. Now, in terms of the actual data they got from it, this is what it looks like. So, the previous Greenland ice cores basically stopped about here. And so what they wanted to do was to see the highest temperature spot in the Eemian epoch and actually be able to get down here. So this is the first time where they've had a Greenland ice core that shows them the complete portion of both the rise of the Eemian and the fall from the Eemian. Whereas before, all they were basically getting was from that point on down. However, I think I want you to notice is that this particular warm interglacial doesn't look anything like the one we're in right now. Now, at the Eemian, notice that the temperature was about 3 degrees warmer than it is today. And by the way, those are Celsius degrees. So if you're talking Fahrenheit, it's about 5 degrees. So the peak temperature at the Eemian, long before human beings were around, was literally 5 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than it is today. And that also has been verified in Antarctica. So it's kind of a global mean temperature increase. But the thing that I think is significant is notice how spiky it is. The temperature goes up to that point, doesn't stay there for very long, and then rapidly drops. Whereas what we're seeing in this warm interglacial, the temperature doesn't come up as high, but notice it stays at a stable level, literally for a little more than 8,000 years. So for the last 8,000 years, it's been stable. Now, when I say stable, you do see some ups and downs, but the ups and downs are basically about a degree Celsius. So they refer to the little ice age during the Dark Ages, where the global average temperature dropped by 1 degree, but it only dropped by 1 degree. Now, it did change things. There was a time before the warm or the little ice age when you could grow grapes in Britain. So just before the what they call little ice age, they actually had a warm episode where Britain got warmer than it is now, and they could actually grow grapes and have wine. And then during the little ice age, it got so cold they couldn't do that anymore. But we're only talking about a 1 degree change. So it did go up and down. See, a 1 degree change isn't going to significantly disrupt civilization. But notice, this is the only warm interglacial where we've seen this. Now here's another one that shows it in a little more detail. And they refer to what we're in right now as the long summer, namely that it has remained warm literally for more than 8,000 years. And it's during the last 8,000 years when humanity has literally been global and civilized, and particularly in the last few centuries, not only global and civilized, but global and civilized at a high technology rate. Now, if you go to Antarctica, we can actually see 8 cycles of the ice ages. What's driving the ice ages is the variation in the shape of Earth's orbit. I don't know if you remember this from your junior high astronomy class, but the planets orbit the sun not in circular orbits, but elliptical orbits. Every orbit is elliptical. That's one of Newton's laws, that the orbits will be elliptical. What's unusual about our solar system planets is that our planets are orbiting the sun in very slightly elliptical orbits. They're basically circles. Planet Earth departs from a perfect circle by only a couple of percent. Mercury is the only one that departs by more than 5%. But that's because it's so tiny and so close to the sun. It gets pretty beat up by the gravitational pull of the sun and Jupiter and Saturn. But all the rest of the planets have very circular orbits, but nonetheless, all of them depart from perfect circularity. And in the case of the Earth, the elliptical shape of the orbit varies a little bit over a 100,000-year cycle. So over 100,000 years, it becomes less elliptical than more elliptical. And when it becomes more elliptical, you get an ice age. And the pattern for the last, so, say, 7 million years is you get a 90,000-year ice age and a 10,000 warm interglacial. However, the warm interglacial has never been like the one we're in right now. All the warm interglacials we can measure with these deep ice cores, and the deepest one is at Dome C in Antarctica, where they've got a little more than 800,000 annual layers. And this is actually from Fuji, which only shows 720,000 years. But you can see the 100,000-year cycle. The red there is the temperature cycle. So if you look at this chart here, it shows you these regular 100,000-year changes in the temperature of planet Earth. But what I want you to notice is when you look at the warm interglacials for the past 8, they're all spiked. Every one of them shows a sharp rise to a maximum temperature, a drop from that temperature back into an ice age. The only time where we see what's called a long summer is the one we're in right now. And this is something that's been especially verified, excuse me, in the Neen core drill. And this is really the reason why they did the NEEM core drill, was they could actually get a very detailed record of what the past cycle looks like. And then they're trying now to figure out why we have a long summer and previous cycles we didn't have a long summer. And there's a lot of speculation to explain the difference. I'll get into that in a minute. But the whole point is we need a long summer to be able to achieve God's goal of enabling human beings to launch and sustain global high-technology civilization. So from God's perspective, He's going to want that. Now, the question that we still have to explore is, why do we have this long summer, and why do we not ever see it in the previous ice age cycles? Yes.
So the only time that these ice ages appear when the Earth's orbit is more elliptical.
No, it's when our orbit is more circular that you get a warm interglacial.
Oh, it's when it's circular.
Yeah. So when it's less circular, then you get an ice age. Now, that's for the last 7 million years. There's actually other factors that determine the climate of planet Earth, and one is the tilt of the plane of the orbit of the Earth, what they call the obliquity. And that also varies over a period of 41,000 years. So if you go back into deep time, not just the last 7 million years, but go back 10, 20 million years, what you discover is a 41,000-year cycle of the tilt in the orbit relative to the solar system plane sometimes plays a more significant role than the variation in the shape of Earth's orbit. And just to be complete, there's a third factor, and that's the wobble in the rotation axis of planet Earth. Like all spinning bodies, our planet has a precession wobble. If you want a visual picture of that, those of you who are older will remember when they had these kids' toys where you have a spinning top and you kind of pull a little lever and it spins really fast, and you can see it spinning fast, but you'd also see it precess. You would watch that spinning top kind of do a very slow precession, so its rotation axis would tilt like that. Well, that happens to planet Earth as well. And it takes 26,000 years to go through one cycle of precession. And so 13,000 years from now, the North Star will be the star Vega. Right now it's Polaris. And by the way, we happen to be living at that time in the precession cycle when we got the best North Star. That peaked around 1998, where we got the closest to Polaris, literally only 3/4 a degree away from Polaris. We're now starting to tilt away. And so as time goes on, Polaris will be less and less effective a pole star as it is right now. And hey, 13,000 years, Vega will be our pole star. And then 13,000 years after that, we'll come back to Polaris. So, but that's kind of the spinning top principle. But that, too, has an effect on the climate of planet Earth. But of the three factors, that is the least effect. The two that are predominant is the tilt of the orbit and then the shape of the orbit. And right now it's the shape of the orbit that's the most significant factor. But the tilt of the orbit explains why you see some variation here. This is driven by the 41,000-year cycle. Here and here is driven by the 100,000-year cycle. So that's why you don't get as smooth of a curve as otherwise you might expect. Yes.
Would the current long summer possibly be explained by a combination of the three different things, the way that they're lined up right now?
Probably not. I mean, you know, people have studied this, said they're wondering if there's something going on in the sun. But the most popular explanation is that it's human activity that explains the warm, long, warm summer. Namely that because of human activity, we wind up artificially changing the temperature of the planet. And of course, there are people worried that with all the industrial activity, we're going to be warming the planet back up to the temperature you see at the last eemian. There are people actually predicting that's going to happen. And when that happens, you're going to have a rise of the sea level. Say, how high was the sea level at the peak of the eemian? It was 6 to 8 meters higher than it is today. So, you know, where I grew up in Vancouver, that would wipe out about three suburbs of Vancouver. because there are two suburbs where the highest elevation above sea level is about 2 feet. So obviously they would be underwater. So, but hey, 6 to 8 meters isn't going to affect us here in Sierra Madre. So will you be any closer to the beach? Only slightly. But hey, it would be damaging for Long Beach. If you're a resident of Long Beach, 6 to 8 meters is a big deal. Or if you're a resident of Florida, most of Florida would be underwater. But also notice that the 6 to 8 feet of increased sea level only lasted for a short time, because it hit that peak temperature, melted all that ice, and then dropped, and then once again the ice began to form. Now probably the biggest discovery that came out of this ice core is the recognition that when we were at the peak of the Eemian, Greenland ice only melted slightly. Not that much of the ice melted. In fact, they determined that the maximum rise of sea level from the warming of Greenland would have been 2 meters, a 2 meter rise. But we know the rise was at least 6 meters, and maybe even as much as 8. And so what this discovery has told us is that the peak of the Eemian, most of the extra water came from Antarctica, not from Greenland. And this is interesting because a lot of the research in global warming is focusing on Greenland. And now people are realizing, because of this ice core drill, that, hey, we really need to focus on Antarctica rather than Greenland. Now, and from one perspective, this makes perfect sense. Because if I could go back to this one right there. Where's all the ice of Greenland? It's sitting on high elevation landmass. So if you warm the planet up a little bit, it's probably not going to affect that ice that much. However, I don't have a slide of Antarctica, but if you go to Antarctica, there's something called the Ross Shelf ice. What it is a huge layer of ice that's not on land. It's sitting on the Antarctic Ocean. And so when you look at a map of Antarctica that shows all the ice, keep in mind a good chunk of that ice is not sitting on land. It's sitting on water. And hey, if you warm the planet up by a couple of degrees, that seawater is going to melt that ice. It probably won't melt the ice on the land masses of Antarctica by much, but the Ross Shelf ice will probably be gone as the planet continues to warm. And there's a lot of ice there, and that would significantly raise the sea levels of a planet Earth. So that's kind of what NEEM has discovered. But what has been completely overlooked is this whole idea of the long summer. You know, as I read the research papers on what this ice core came about, it was all about contrasting ice melt in Antarctica with ice melt in Greenland, and not any comments at all on this. See if I can get this back here. Here we go. On this long summer that we see there. There was a question back there, yes.
Is the Ross Ice Shelf floating on the water?
It's floating on the water.
Well, then, if the ice melts, it won't raise the sea level, would it? I mean, if you have your glass and have some ice water or something in it, and the ice melts, it doesn't raise the level.
Well, what's going to happen is all that ice that's sitting above sea level is now going to be in the water, and that's going to raise the sea level of the whole planet. Okay,
you know, that ice is displacing water, right?
It is. But if you melt it all, I mean, just kind of think about it. Put some ice cubes in a glass, and if you have a lot of ice sitting above the surface, you melt all the ice, the level of the water will go up. It won't go up by much, but it will go up. So yeah, if you've got a couple of thousand feet of ice sitting above the Antarctic Ocean, and you melt all that, it will raise the sea level of the whole planet. Again, not by as much as the ice is above it, but it will do it. Yes?
Well, a couple of things. It seems to me like the sun would have a bigger impact as it expands on our weather. And also, do they get the same data in Antarctica as they do in the...
They see the long summer in all the ice core drills. So it shows up in all seven deep ice core drills. There's three deep ones in Antarctica, four in Greenland, and all of them show, quote, the long summer. But it's not just a long summer. What I want you to notice is it's the only time in the whole graph where the temperature stays at a constant level. And in fact, when you call it a long summer, that summer isn't as warm as the Eemian. So we actually have a cooler summer than we did at the last warm interglacial. But the most significant factor is it's lasted a long time, and it's lasted a long time where the temperature has hardly changed at all. And this is exactly what you need to launch and sustain global high technology civilization. And of course, now the big question is, what's the cause of this? And I'm excited about that because I think there's something in there that's going to show supernatural design that we've not uncovered to this date. Yes. And by the way, I have a hard time seeing you because there's bright light right behind you.
I know the frequency is small, but what's the solar system's position in the Milky Way, being in one of the arms? I know that if at some point it will come out of one of the arms and be in much less dense space at some point. Does that obviously...
Well, good question. And, Al here raised the question, well, what about the brightening of the sun? The sun is getting brighter and brighter as it continues to fuse hydrogen to helium. And yes, the sun is also revolving around the center of the galaxy. And when we enter into a spiral arm, that will affect the climate. Now, the time scales for both of those are very long. It takes a quarter of a billion years for the sun to make one trip around the center of our galaxy. And so it'll be a while before we cross the spiral arm. Right now, we're in between the Perseus and Sagittarius spiral arms. And that's actually ideal for human civilization. You don't want to be around a spiral arm. So when are we going to cross the spiral arm next? About a half billion years from now. So it's about 600 million years ago we last crossed the spiral arm. There's something significant about that, because 600 million years ago was right before the Cambrian Avalon explosions of life. And so, you know, that would have made things quite disturbing for life here on planet Earth. And it's like God waited till we crossed that spiral arm. Then he jumped in with the Avalon and Cambrian explosions of life. But yeah, we're safe for another half billion years, if that's any comfort to your investment portfolio. And in terms of the sun getting brighter and brighter, yes, it eventually is going to make the planet sufficiently warm that we'll no longer be able to sustain global civilization. When will that happen? You're probably safe for about another 3 million years. And even after that, you could still have human beings living on the planet. But within 10 million years, the sun will be too bright to enable human beings to live in any kind of technological state here on planet Earth, or even to live in a Stone Age technology state. We'll be one of the first species to have to say bye-bye as the sun continues to get brighter and brighter. The cockroaches will last about another 10 million years. Bacteria will be the last to go. But 30 million years from now, our planet Earth will become sterile because of the brightening of the sun. And hey, if you wait long enough, the sun will not, you know, as it gets brighter, it gets bigger. And eventually it'll get to be so big that the sun's diameter will encompass the orbit of planet Earth.
When will it explode into...
Well, that won't happen until about 4 billion years from now. 4 billion years from now, we'll be inside the diameter of the sun. So what happens then? The sun vaporizes planet Earth. So, and that actually has some theological impact. I know theologians who are convinced that the new creation is eternal life here on planet Earth. And so I've been speaking at their seminary saying, well, that's probably not a realistic scenario given what's going to happen to the sun. And hey, if you wait long enough, the Milky Way galaxy is going to collide with the Andromeda galaxy, and that's going to lead to some unpleasant consequences for advanced life here on planet Earth. So you better come up with a different interpretation of Scripture. Yes?
How long is this long summer?
Well, the long summer has lasted a little more than 8,000 years so far, and we're still in the long summer. And you notice that about 8,500 years ago is when humans began to sustain global civilization. The Neolithic Revolution was 12,000 years ago, and this is where civilization first appears in Mesopotamia, the Persian Gulf, and regions just a little bit beyond that. But 8,500 years ago is where it spreads to Asia, Africa, and Europe. So that's the first time we really see human civilization in a global context. But it happened at the beginning of the long summer. Before that, you still were dealing with the remnants of the last ice age, and the temperature was changing. Notice how rapidly the temperature is changing just before the onset of the long summer, which basically forced humanity to stay in the tropics. But once that temperature came up, now humans could actually spread up over the planet. Yes, Ross.
How do our young Earth brothers deal with the ice core issue, showing that there's been at least 800,000 years of activity?
Well, whenever I debate a young Earth creationist at a public event, I bring up the ice cores. Mainly because lay audiences can see how powerful a piece of evidence this is against the young Earth position. The young Earth response is to say these layers aren't annual. But that's a really hard spot for them to try to sustain. Number one, we see in these ice layers the dust signatures of volcanic eruptions that occurred in human recorded history. So, for example, you can go into an ice core and find the dust layer of the 79 AD eruption of Vesuvius. Each volcano has got its own unique dust signature. So you can find Krakatoa, you can find Vesuvius, and you can count the layers between Vesuvius and Krakatoa, and it's exactly what the human calendar tells us is a separation between those two volcanic eruptions.
What about Popocatépetl?
Oh, that's probably there too. I mean, they found about a dozen different signatures. But I think the most persuasive evidence is what you see back here, is that you can actually see the effect of the variation of the eccentricity of Earth's orbit. And you can actually see eight of them in the deepest ice core in Antarctica. Moreover, they've got a mud core drill off the shore of New Zealand. Now, it doesn't show you annual layers, but it shows you layers that are roughly equivalent to a century. But that takes you back 4 million years. So you actually can see 40 cycles of the variation in Earth's eccentricity being reflected in that core. Now, what that does is it forces the young Earth creationists to say, well, I guess Newtonian physics isn't correct. But they know that's not going to go very far. The evidence in favor of Newton's laws of motion is very strong. And so, given that we can actually see what Newtonian mechanics predicts for the effect of the orbit of planet Earth, really does demonstrate that the Earth at a minimum must be 40 million years old.
Must they appeal to the appearance of age?
Well, when I've publicly presented this, their response has been, well, we see ice in southern Greenland where you get many layers per year. And I says, yeah, but that's southern Greenland, where in the summer it gets warm enough to melt the ice. These deep ice cores were purposely done in places of the world where we know it never gets warm enough to melt the ice. And the very fact is that you can count the number of layers from one warm interglacial to the next, and it matches a 100,000-year cycle. We can see the dust signatures of the volcanoes throughout recorded human history. These really are annual layers. And therefore, and I talked to one young Earth creationist, and he says, Hugh, when you speak, I hope you don't mention the ice cores. So they themselves see this as a very potent piece of evidence against their position, mainly because it's so easy to understand. You know, lay people see this right away. Whereas when I start talking about light travel times and talking about the cooling curves of white dwarfs, they say, I think this is beyond my physics training. Very powerful piece of evidence, but if the lay audience doesn't understand it, it doesn't have the same impact. Whereas this is something I think people can easily visualize as demonstrating. And by the way, as we go through these ice layers, there's no flood signature. If the flood was global in extent, it would show up in the ice cores. So this is demonstrates that the Genesis flood could not have ever impacted Greenland or Antarctica. Because there's no layer that would show any evidence of that phenomena. So I've often used that as a demonstration. The flood of Noah is worldwide, but not global. Worldwide to all of humanity, but humanity was living before the long summer. Before the long summer, there'd be a powerful motivation not to inhabit the whole planet. I mean, if you want to live up in Fort McMurray 20,000 years ago, it would not be a very pleasant place. Even now, they get 70 below winters. Back then, it would have been much harsher, and it would have been below freezing even in the summertime. So that's one reason it explains why humanity kind of stayed in the warm places. Yes?
Yeah, how far back do ice ages go, and before that, why weren't there ice ages?
Well, actually, if you go back quite a bit in history, you not only get ice ages, you get snowball events. Now, a snowball event is an ice age where you get ice covering about 80 to 90% of the planet. So basically, the Amazon jungle would be ice free, the Congo would be ice free, everywhere else you got ice. But the last snowball event was 600 million years ago. But before that, snowball events were quite frequent. We know there's been at least four, there could have been as many as eight snowball events. Now, as far as ice ages, given what we know about the Earth's orbit, the belief is that ice ages have been a permanent feature of planet Earth. But in terms of hard evidence, detailed evidence of what each ice age is looking like, it only goes back about 7 million years. Now, based on what we know about the Earth's orbit, it went back further than that. But once you get past 7 million years ago, the data is much sketchier than what we see here. So, I mean, we have data, but it's not as good as what you're looking at here. So, yeah, this is where you got Antarctica, which kind of shows. And on our website, I actually show you the one from Dome C, where you get to see eight complete cycles, the variation in Earth's orbit. Okay, if you want to know more about this, there's actually a podcast on our website that we recorded Friday. I think the podcast is going to go up Monday, so you can check that out in more detail. But I'll turn the computer off now. We'll get back into the text. I think what would be good to do, just to kick off on this, is let's begin with the frozen precipitations and try to examine why we need snow, hail, frost, ice, and why we need the surface of the Earth to be significantly frozen in different parts of the world, and not just ice on Greenland, but also ice that floats above the ocean. Why all of that is necessary. This is what we got from the book of Job. But beginning with snow. Now, we live here in California, and where do we get our snow?
The mountains.
The mountains, yeah. So, you know, you can look over to Mount Baldy, and in January and February, there'll be snow on Mount Baldy. And you go into the Sierras, you'll get snow. San Gregorio, which is about 80 miles from here, you can get as much as 30 feet of snow on the top of San Gregorio in the wintertime. One reason why I think there is some credence for global warming, I remember coming here in the 70s, and every year they would get a minimum of 20 feet of snowpack in the Sierras and an equal amount on San Gregorio. We only get that occasionally now. But what does snow do for California? Pardon me? It provides water. How? Okay, what does melting snow do for you?
Slows down the process
where you last saw rivers. That's it. Okay, when rain falls from the sky, you get a temporary inundation of the land. The advantage of snow is that it melts slowly, which means that you can actually have a steady stream. So anywhere in California where you see a river or a stream that flows all year round, it's because it's being fed by snow melt. You're not going to get permanent rivers here. What was it Mark Twain that said about California? California is the one state of the Union where you can fall in the river and you get dusty. Because most of our riverbeds are dry most of the year. There's only water in them for a few days out of the year. You know, the Los Angeles River, It's basically a concrete, tube that...
I used to swim there.
Used to swim there as a kid, but hey, it's dry most of the time. But we actually do have, like, for example, you can go to the base of Mount Baldy. There's a creek that comes off of Mount Baldy. It flows all year round. There's a waterfall there. It flows all year round. Why? Because there's permanent snow on Mount Baldy. So that means that you get... And by the way, when you go to those rivers, what do you notice? The water flow is about the same all the time. In fact, what's interesting is that it diminishes in the wintertime when it's cold, and then you get more when it's warm. And the advantage to those of us in California, when do we typically get our rain? In the wintertime. Okay, so that's when you got liquid precipitation. The summertime, we get water from snowmelt. And when it's warm, you get more water. When it's cold, you get less water from the snowmelt. So what that does for us is it gives us a regular supply of water we can count on, which we can use to have extensive farms. You know, of all the states in the Union, California has the greatest agricultural production, even though our rainfall is quite small relative to other states. So if we didn't have snow, we wouldn't be able to have the agricultural industry that we do. Yes?
In the West, as you know very well, our rain is seasonal. Even in Seattle, it's very seasonal.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get it in the summertime. Whereas in the east part of the United States, it's much more even. It is somewhat seasonal, but it's much more even. So we are absolutely dependent on our snowmelt.
We're very dependent on the snowmelt. Yes, you are right. People back east are less dependent, because they get a more regular supply of the liquid precipitation. However, that frozen precipitation also helps the farmers, because you know you're going to get a lot more water flowing into the Missouri and Mississippi from the winter snowmelt than you would the rest of the time of the year. Yes.
Is the unevenness of the Earth's surface come into play as well? Because the only reason why we have that snow is we have elevated land mass. So if we were truly a more flat topography here, like the Sahara, this would be a dramatically different place.
Well, this is something that's special about our planet, and I don't think it's an accident. I think this is all part of God's design. If you look at North America, you've got what's called the Cordillera, which is basically a mountain range that runs from the north tip of Alaska all the way down to the Cape Horn at the bottom tip of South America. But what you typically notice...
Cordillera is what you say in Spanish.
Okay.
Cordillera.
Very good. But what you notice about those mountains, once you get away from Alaska and the Yukon, is that the mountains get higher as you come towards the equator. And so, for example, in British Columbia, a really high mountain is 10,000 feet. But at 10,000 feet, given that latitude, it has a lot of snow on it. The snowpack on the mountains in British Columbia is much heavier than it is here in California. But, you know, how high are our mountains? 14,000 feet. If the mountains here were only 10,000 feet, you wouldn't get much of a snowpack. But because they're 12 to 14,000 feet high, you get a heavy snowpack. Then you go down to Mexico. How high are the mountains there? 17,000 feet. And so even though Mexico is quite close to the equator, their mountains are high enough where they get snowmelt. And this is what sustains a lot of the agriculture in Mexico.
They get snow in Mexico shady in the wintertime, too.
Well, then you go down to South America, and you see the same thing. You go down into Argentina and Chile, the mountains aren't that high. But as you move up into Peru and Ecuador, the mountains get much higher. And, you know, even on the equator, they have snow-packed mountains, which is what, you know, keeps a regular supply of water going. You go to Asia, you see something similar. Where are the highest mountains in Asia?
China.
The Himalayas. Himalayas aren't far from the equator, but because they're so incredibly high, there's a lot of snow and glaciers there, and this is what keeps the Ganges flowing, and it keeps those huge Chinese rivers flowing. They're basically dependent on the snow and glacier melt off of the Himalayas. And as you go farther north into the Urals aren't that high, But because you're now in Siberia, even though they're only 4,000 to 5,000 feet high, it's high enough where you get a snowpack. So that keeps snow melting and feeding the rivers throughout Russia and Siberia. It could have gone the other way around. If it was the other way around, then we wouldn't be able to have the human population and the extent of agriculture that we do. And keep in mind, we live in a dynamic planet. The continents have not always been the way they are right now. And the mountains aren't always the way they are right now. And this is a point we've made here before in the class. We're living at a geologically optimal time. When the continents are placed just right, the size is just right, they oriented just right. And the orientation we need to pay attention to. North and South America are basically oriented north-south. That's also true of Africa and Europe. And because of that north-south orientation, the winds that blow over the oceans drop significant precipitation on the continental land masses. If our continents were oriented east-west instead of north-south, you'd have significantly less precipitation falling on the continental land masses. Yes?
Is there a geologic or tectonic reason why the higher mountains are closer to the equator?
That's a mystery. But, I mean, yeah, we can understand that the tectonics of the planet is working such to drive those mountains up right now. But it's like right now, you're seeing something similar to what I showed you about the long summer. We're also in a unique time in tectonic history where we got the just best possible continents and just best possible elevation of the mountains so that we can sustain a huge human population at a high technology level. When you go back 20 million years, it wouldn't be like that. 50 million years ago, there were no Himalayas. 50 million years ago, India was still offshore. Now it's crashing into Asia. And by the way, the Himalayas are getting higher and higher every year, which is a good thing because when you're in a warm interglacial, that means you're going to have glaciers melting fairly rapidly. But if the mountains are going up, then that's going to mean you're going to stick in. So that's one reason why we have a longer summer, is we're at a time when the mountains close to the equator are still going up. By the way, we're living in a region where our mountains are going up at a rapid rate. These mountains north of you are going up at a rate of 9 millimeters a year. So any of you who live in one of these foothill towns, you are the owners of future mountain property. Pardon me?
Things are looking up?
Things are looking up, definitely. Might have a little farther to get to the beach, but you've got a shorter trip to get to the mountains and the ski slopes. Yes, go ahead.
That picture you had of I used to work on the Arctic Circle, right between Greenland and Canada. And we used to go to a little town there called Jakobshavn.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we used to crew change there and flew in a helicopter down these, what do you call them, the places with a big gash in the ocean. And then at the end, you'd have the town, what do you call it,
A fjord?
Fjord.
Yeah.
Fjord. And it was the most beautiful sight in the world. You see these ice, the ice coming down to the edge of the fjord and then come down, and the water down there was just milky white from the crushed rock as the ice came sliding down. And it was just a gorgeous sight. But at that time, I mean, Greenland, this was in the 80s, and it was just full of snow, Greenland. And later on, a few years back, I flew across here like that in a plane, a star from Europe, almost brown. You know, it used to be all white.
Right.
It's all brown.
I could go back to the map, but yeah. That map is recent. But yeah, if you were to go back even 100 years, the snow over Greenland was much closer to the sea than it is today. Where they've been experiencing the greatest melt of Greenland ice is at low elevation right by the sea. But this is what is enabling the population of Greenland to expand. you know, there's about 25,000 people living in Greenland now, mainly because, you know, snow's been melting and they've been able to get some fishing and mining going. And in the Canadian side, there's a booming tourist industry. Now, you're talking about just how beautiful it is where you see those carved out valleys. The place in the world where you've got the highest vertical walls is Baffin Island. I mean, kind of what you see in Yosemite, you see 4,000 foot high walls that have been carved by ancient glaciers. In Baffin Island, they're more than 6,000 feet high.
Okay,
and so
we went through. They looked like they were about 3,000 or 4,000 feet. I mean, there was.
Yeah, it's just sheer granite walls, and just incredible beauty. But now there's actually a daily service to Frobisher Bay, where they bring tourists in to see these structures.
Yeah, well, we used to take off from Baffin Island.
Mm-hmm.
From Chicago, from Baffin Island.
No, you probably landed in Frobisher Bay. That's the big city in Baffin Island.
Yeah.
Big city, 3,000 people. So, okay. Anyway, that's snow. This is why we need snow. Snow falls on mountains. And by the way, if you look in Genesis 2, it talks about how four rivers joined together in the Garden of Eden. Today, only two of those rivers are flowing. The other two, the Kihon and the Pishon, have stopped flowing. They're now dry. The reason why they're dry, the snow is all melted. If you go back to the last ice age, the mountains of Arabia were snow-covered. The mountains in the south tip of Arabia down by Yemen, they were also snow-covered. All that snow is now gone.
That's where you have the Arabian desert.
But it's a desert now because the snow has all been melted. But what the Bible tells us in Genesis 2 is the Gihon flowed out of... try to remember the technical term, Cush. Now, Cush we typically identify with Ethiopia, but at the close of the last ice age, the southern western tip of Arabia was joined to Africa. There was a land bridge. There's mountains on the Arabian side, there's mountains on the African side. So it talks about how the Gihon flows out of the region of Cush, and this would have been that mountainous region where it was all joined together. Arabia was joined to Africa, and it says that the river flowed into the Garden of Eden. Then it talks about the Pishon flowing out of the region of Havilah, where there is gold. And that's referring to the mountains in the central part of the Arabian Peninsula, and how that too flowed into the Garden of Eden. Then it names two well-known rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, that likewise flow into the Garden of Eden. Now, the Gihon and the Pishon flow in southern Arabia. But at that time, what we now call the Persian Gulf was mostly dry land. And so personally, I think the biblical site for the Garden of Eden is in the southeastern portion, what we now call the Persian Gulf. And at that time, all four rivers would have come together in one location. The Tigris and Euphrates still flow today. Why? Because the mountains of Ararat still have a heavy snow cover. There's actually glaciers on Mount Ararat, and those glaciers are melting. And that melting ice is what's feeding the Tigris and Euphrates.
Part of Ararat's on the Turkish side, and part of it's on the Armenian side.
That's right. It's on the Turkish, Russian, or Armenian border. But the mountains of Ararat, where it says the ark came to rest, is actually not referring to Mount Ararat itself. It's actually covering the whole region of Armenia. It's about 100,000 square miles. So my favorite site for where the ark came to rest are the foothills of Ararat, probably just a few miles north of Nineveh. And that's included in what's called the mountains of Ararat. But yeah, there's still snow there, still ice pack, and that explains why those two rivers are flowing. When that snow and ice disappears, the Euphrates and the Tigris will become just like the Gihon and the Pishon. They'll become dry riverbeds as well. So that kind of gives a good understanding why we need snow and why we need a lot of the snow. By the way, I grew up in Vancouver, British Columbia, city of 3 million people. They get their entire water supply from melting snow, and they get their entire water supply from a watershed that's 11 square miles. 11 square miles gives all the water 3 million people need. Why? Because at 11 square miles, gets 300 feet of snow per year. Now, here we talk about inches of snow at our ski resorts. In Canada, they talk about feet of snow at their ski resorts. But that's one place where they literally get 300 feet of snow in the wintertime, and then they count on that melting snow to provide water for the entire city. So that's a dramatic example where intense snowfall provides a steady flow of water to sustain high civilization for literally millions of people. And that's just one example of their examples. Okay, what I want to do next week is to talk about, I don't think I'm going to be here next week. I'm coming back on an airplane from Montana next week, but I will be here the week thereafter. So, but how about this? You can either do this in my absence or wait till I get back. I don't know what you guys have got scheduled.
I think you are going to be here.
Yeah, you sure.
I'm going to be here? Calendar shows me being here. I'm flying back on the 4th.
Okay, then Katie Galloway will be here on the 4th.
Katie Galloway? You're going to love Katie Galloway. She's a really gifted public speaker, and she's an adjunct scholar with us right now. She's with us on our staff, but the good news is that, number one, the paper based on her PhD thesis research has been accepted for publication in Science Magazine. That hardly ever happens.
Science Magazine
is publishing her article. And that's really rare for a brand new PhD scientist to get a paper published in Science.
On what?
She did her thesis research on what controls the complex machines that we see inside the cell. And so, you know, there's been a lot of research on how evidence for supernatural design of these amazing machines, molecular machines we see inside the cell. I went to Katie's PhD thesis defense, and I love the way she started it. As complex and as difficult as it is to explain the design of these molecular machines inside the cell, an order of magnitude greater challenge is to explain the control systems. And that's what her thesis is all about. What is it that controls these machines? How are they managed? And what we notice is they're optimally managed. I don't know what she's going to speak about. Her postdoc, which is going to start at USC, she just was told that she's been accepted as a postdoc at USC. And a real kudo for her, a couple of weeks after she got accepted at USC, she was also accepted for a grant that funds her postdoctoral research. Now, what's significant about that is where you're externally funded, you basically get to do the research that you want to do. So that really helped me when I was at Caltech, that I had external funding. But the fact is she was accepted even before she had the funding. So, yeah, so I think late September she's going to start her postdoc, and then we're looking forward to bringing her on staff full time when she's done with her postdoc studies. But she said, since it's USC, I'll be available. So, hey, if you want to bring her in for a follow-up, she would be available. But yeah, ask her any question you want on stem cells or biochemical design. That's kind of her forte. So feel free to invite people that are interested in that subject. And I think you'll really enjoy her. She's a great speaker. Yeah, go ahead.
What edition is of Science is her article in?
Oh, it's been accepted for publication. It's not yet published. I'm guessing it'll probably come out as an online article within probably 3 or 4 weeks, and then it'll actually show up in print.
What's her name again?
Katie Galloway.
Galloway,
right. Yeah, so.
I subscribe to Science, so I'll be looking for it.
Yeah, definitely be looking for it. Her name will be on the paper. I didn't realize this, but I actually got to meet her when she was 3 years old.
Really?
Well, her parents, they're called, the Groffs, and they showed up about 27 years ago at one of our days of prayer and fasting for the Ministry of Reasons to Believe, and they brought their 3-year-old daughter with them. Turns out that's Katie Galloway. I did not know that until I discovered that Fuzz was saying, hey, we really need to take advantage of this gal at Caltech. She's doing amazing work. And so even as a grad student, she was writing articles for us. And when she got her PhD, I found out, because I met her parents at the thesis defense, and, oh, this is our daughter. I says, oh, I remember when Katie was 3 years of age. So anyway, we're trying to raise a new generation of science apologists, and she's part of that new generation. Hey, I'm a little bit over my time. Let me pray. But hey, what we're going to talk about next time that I get together with you is why we need hail and why we need frost. And think about it. Where does hail fall on the earth? It falls in a different place than the snow falls. By the way, I've never seen snow in the 27. Gee, I've been here 40 years in California. Can't believe I've been here that long. But in the 40 years, I've never seen snow fall at this elevation. But I have seen hail. In fact, the townhouse we had in San Dimas, 1 year, we had 5 inches of hail. Okay, just something for you to think about. Why is it that hail falls in different places than the snow falls? And what about the frost? I don't know how many of you have really seen much frost. Frost here in California is not very spectacular. It's kind of like a little white fuzz in the grass and that's it. But as a Canadian, I can tell you, I've seen frost this high. I've actually seen frost about that high. And that frost has special characteristics. Anyway, we'll talk about that. Father in heaven, we do thank you for this planet Earth that you've created for us and designed for us. Thank you, Lord, that you've placed us human beings here at this special time when we're actually having this long, long summer. And a long, long summer that's not as hot as the previous summers we've seen in previous ice ages. And Lord, I pray that as we continue to study the record of nature, who give us some insight on why it is that we're in such a long, benign summer as we're in. And Father, I pray that that would show us more of your handiwork than we've been able to see so far. So we look forward to that day, Lord, when we have that kind of understanding. But Father, thank you for these texts that we see in the Bible that talk in such great detail about the water cycle that you've set up and designed here on planet Earth. Help us understand why we have a water cycle, why we have such a unique water cycle, and why it's designed in such a way as to maximally bless us human beings. And most of all, Lord, I pray you give us some insight into what you expect us to do with this incredible blessing. So, Lord, show us our purpose and our destiny, both corporately as a human race, but also individually as a human being within that human race. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.